Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Hey, thanks for listening. This is Sari Kamen with HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm in the studio today with some very special guests, as well as some that are on the phone with me today. We're going to be talking about ag gag laws, which is a pretty big issue in the United States right now. And I have a couple people to comment on those. Some of them are experts. In the studio with me today is Katie Kiefer. Hi, Katie.
Hi, sorry.
She is a food journalist. She's worked as a cook and a butcher and a caterer, and she's also a host on Heritage Radio Network. I have Vickery Eckhoff with me, who's also a journalist. Hi, Vickery.
Hi, sorry.
She works for Forbes.com, and she is going to be here talking about an incident that she experienced as a journalist. And on the line with me, I have Mickey Osterreicher. Hi, Mickey.
Hello. How are you, Sari?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well.
He serves as general counsel to the National Press Photographers Association. He's an award-winning photojournalist. And I also have Suzanne McMillan. She's from ASPCA. She's the director of their farm animal welfare campaign. Suzanne?
Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Great. So this is a really, really hot topic, and I know some of you were either involved or witnessed a panel that went on about 2 weeks ago at Columbia University where you were talking about all the different various issues that came up. So, Suzanne, I thought maybe you could start us off and just kind of, for you know everyone who's listening at home, sort of bring us up to speed with what's going on, give us a little background to the history of ag gag laws, maybe tell us which states have bills pending right now, just where we are with everything.
Sure. So just to give people a brief definition of what these bills are, they look to essentially restrict whistleblower activity, generally at farm or agricultural settings, so on farms, at slaughterhouses, places like that. But recently we've actually seen bills become increasingly broad to the point where they're implicating other industry sectors and sometimes not even any sectors at all by name, but essentially just applying themselves to all of industry, which is extremely disturbing. And this trend really began back in the 90s. We saw several states pass similar bills, and then it came back again around 2011 when we saw five bills introduced and none passed. But in 2012, we saw 10 bills, and unfortunately, several made it through. And now this year, we've seen about 12 bills, so the number keeps going up, which is extremely disconcerting. But we've also seen a wonderful trend of lawmakers and the public beginning to realize what these bills are really about. And so we've seen some really sound defeats. So, for example, just recently in Pennsylvania, the legislator who had announced publicly that he intended to sponsor an ag gag bill decided to cancel his plans to bring one forward. In Tennessee, the bill was actually just vetoed by the governor a few days ago, and that came right on the heels of the Tennessee Attorney General declaring it to be constitutionally suspect. And now we have a big fight in North Carolina with a pending bill. So those are probably the three that are highlights for your listeners.
Right. And so far in 2013, no bills have passed. Is that correct?
That's correct. Well, we had the vetoed Tennessee bill. So it did pass the legislature, and then it was vetoed by the governor. So it did not become law.
Right.
So far, we have defeated every bill.
Okay. And so we have North Carolina sort of in limbo right now.
Yes.
So Tennessee was really surprising because I think most people thought that since it had already passed, it was going to go through. And so what do you think, because a lot of people associate these bills with more conservative states, why did the governor of Tennessee make the call as you did?
I think it was very much that, again, it came right on the heels of the Attorney General coming out publicly and declaring it, you know, conducting his own legal analysis on the bill and finding 3 points that concerned him specific to the Constitution. And so his ultimate finding was that the bill is constitutionally suspect. Now, that's a very difficult thing. You know, these points had been raised already publicly to the legislature and to the public. You know, those of us fighting these bills have talked over and over again about the constitutional deficits of these bills. But hearing it directly from an attorney general carries quite a bit of weight, and it would be, I think, a really tough political situation for a governor to go against that.
Yeah, but we've seen examples of that happen. And I mean, a lot of it is because the corporate industries are so closely tied to the governments. And I think that's where it gets tricky and why a lot of, you know, the bills are able to be rationalized by the people who make these legislative decisions. And maybe both you and Katie could talk about sort of like the different arguments that, you know, we see when it comes to debating the bill.
Sure.
I mean, I know, Katie, you've interviewed a couple of people who've been on the opposite side. You've talked to Emily Meredith, who's with the Animal Agricultural Alliance.
That's right.
So she represents that organization as someone in the public who's pro the bill. And how does she rationalize it when you were talking to her?
Well, within the meat industry, they actually don't call this ag gag. They consider it quite insulting. That it's denominated in that way. They refer to it as farm protection bills. And they object to the idea that they're being spied on. And most farmers and ranchers are very proud of the way they take care of their animals, and they consider it really sort of beyond the pale and literally an intrusion in their privacy about how they run their farms, which, you know, I can actually understand that feeling. And I think that the ag gag bills are not targeted so much toward farmers and ranchers as they are towards packing plants and slaughterhouses. And this is where you run into the situation of seeing those horrible videos, such as the one that brought down Westlake Hallmark a few years ago, or some of the other subsequent videos where, you know, turkeys are being kicked or piglets are being, you know, bashed in the head and stuff like that. And those generally take place within the confines of packing houses, although the piglets, I have to say, is a different story. And I think that there is a justifiable concern on the part of the meat industry that things that they consider the norm are, according to them, taken out of context. They believe edited. I'm not speaking for it. I'm
right,
just saying
course.
What they believe. Because I do talk a lot to the meat industry because I do want to understand their point of view.
Which is why you're here.
Yeah, exactly. And so they believe that these incidents are taken out of context, that the videos are being edited to represent the worst, and that frequently the footage that is taken is, for instance, the piglet thing. That's a very upsetting video, and yet that is the veterinarian prescribed method for euthanizing piglets, is to bash their heads on a concrete floor. Sounds horrible, but in fact it kills them very quickly, and they don't apparently suffer. So I don't know whether that's true or not. I'm just telling you that's the industry norm. But to the consuming public, when they see something like that, they freak out, quite understandably. And this is where ag gag comes, you know, really comes down to it. It's like, what is industry norm and what is out and out abuse? And what they fear about these videos is, and quite rightfully so, is that it shows stuff that, first of all, isn't necessarily abuse, even though it might look that way to us. And then, of course, they don't want to get caught with their pants down when there's actually real, genuine abuse going on,
right,
which
yeah.
unfortunately happens all too often.
This is where things get tricky. And Suzanne, I know you can definitely speak to this. And Katie, because you talked to Paul Shapiro from Human Rights or Humane Society.
Humane Society.
Sorry about that. What is the purpose of the ag gag laws? Because for some, you know, people who don't necessarily know these laws very well, standard practices can appear shocking.
Absolutely.
And then there's the instances of just obscene abuse.
Of genuine abuse.
And cruelty.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if we put it in front of the general public, it would probably be hard in a lot of situations just to be able to differentiate that or discern. So, I mean, are the ag gag laws, are they there to just, you know, make people aware of standard general practices and how much better they need to be? Do we need to start looking at just, you know, rewriting the infrastructure, or are there to expose these extreme examples of cruelty?
Well, the ag gag laws are definitely there to protect the industry from what appears to be system-wide animal rights abuse. Right, Suzanne, don't you think? I mean, my feeling is that this is purely for them to cover their asses. And but at the same time, there are certain reasons why maybe that's not such a bad idea.
But I'm not necessarily just talking about what's on paper, because I think that that's very clear. We all understand that ag gag laws.
Well, when they start telling the EPA that they can't do flyovers of sewage lagoons outside of a pig CAFO, then, you know, then we're talking about ag gag taken to a totally different level.
Absolutely.
And but that, I think, is completely
Suzanne, what's your response? Because right. I think that a lot of people think that ag gag laws have like a secret ulterior motive or a hidden agenda. And there's a lot of fear and paranoia coming from the meat industry, who are concerned that the actual overriding agenda of exposing these practices is to like turn everyone into a vegan. Can you comment on that?
Right. I would really just love to make the point first that, you know, what is standard practice and what is abusive towards animals raised for food on farms? Those two things are not necessarily mutually exclusive, and oftentimes they are not. And that's part of what these videos do a great job of explaining to the public. So the systemic cruelty that happens to these animals all too often is legal. But just because it's legal does not mean that it's not abusive. And I'm thinking of examples like the extreme confinement that some of these animals are kept in. I'm sure we've all heard of gestation crates.
Yeah.
Battery cages. Cows, right, battery cages, veal crates. You know, these are legal in most states. Some of the forms of mutilations that are done to these animals without painkiller, you know, being dehorned, being branded, being castrated, having the ends of their beaks burned off without painkiller. You know, that's something that any reasonable person would be concerned about. It's something that if it were done to a dog or a cat, would, you know, you would be arrested for doing that. So I think it's reasonable to ask questions about why these things are legal and why they're going on. You know, why the farm industry doesn't at least voluntarily begin phasing them out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just the examples of gratuitous violence, you know, animals being kicked and stomped on. It really is about the day-to-day suffering of these animals, the misery, and really the lack of legal oversight, because these animals have no federal protection and virtually no state protection in farms.
Poultry,
so
literally,
really, it's left to the whistleblower.
Yeah.
You know, it's left to consumers to take some action and lean on big ag to do something about this.
And just to add to that, poultry, apparently, and I just learned this, Suzanne, I'm sure you know it already, poultry literally has no legal protection.
That's right, yeah, it's not covered under the Humane Method of Slaughter Act.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's just astonishing.
Right. They're written out.
It is astonishing. Mm-hmm. I want to hear from Mickey before we sort of get into like the thick of it with, you know, debating the ethics and all of that, because once again, Mickey's here representing the legal side. Mickey, you represent photojournalists. Can you just talk about what rights journalists have at this point, or any cases that you've had to represent recently?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things we look at is First Amendment rights and constitutional rights, and obviously that was one of the things that the Tennessee Attorney General found suspect. And we've written letters supported by other news organizations and media organizations in a number of these cases. In particular, one of the ones we could talk about is in Utah, where this was going to be one of the first actual prosecutions of somebody under an ag gag bill. And at the very last minute, when this information kind of went viral, the prosecuting attorney there decided to drop the charges. And really, in that case, you had a woman who was told, hey, if you go down this street and you're standing on a public sidewalk, you can clearly see in and see animals and see what's going on without, you know, the aid of a long lens or anything else. And that's exactly what happened, at least, the way we understand it, is that she was standing on a sidewalk. She was taking a video. Somebody from inside the plant approached her, told her to stop. She said, no, I'm within my rights. I'm in a public place. And, the next thing you know, the police were called, and then claims were made that she actually trespassed on the property. At some point, I believe the prosecution looked at her video, realized that that wasn't the case, and I think that's one of the reasons why the prosecution was dropped. But we see this all the time in terms of some of the language of these laws being so overly broad that it implicates First Amendment rights. We're not talking about, I mean, if somebody's trespassing, there's a law for that already.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody's doing something that is an illegal activity, there is usually a law for that. But what happens here is we're creating enhanced penalties for what was normally protected, either free speech or free press rights, and we're either adding civil penalties or criminalizing them. And then, you know, some of the other issues in a number of these bills, they have a mandatory reporting requirement, whereby if you photograph and record something within, and it depends, in some it's 24 hours, in some it's 48 hours, that you turn over unedited that recording or those photographs to law enforcement. And so we look at that, and in Tennessee they had that, and the Attorney General looked at that as a prior restraint, and that's a problem with the First Amendment. It's also a problem in terms of due process. When you are mandatorily required to turn over something that you would normally have a right to, there's a process for that. Whether somebody wants to get a search warrant or a subpoena or whatever for that material, here you don't have any of that due process, so that's a 14th Amendment violation. And then the other thing that made at least the Tennessee law suspect is the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, because here, you know, there's a criminal statute that says if you do this, you violated the law, and also you need to turn over evidence that you've done it, so you've clearly implicated yourself. So these are the kinds of things that we're seeing, unfortunately, at least from our perspective, the NPPA's perspective. This is just one of a number of these types of feel-good bills that address certain constituencies. We've seen other ones, such as anti-paparazzi measures, that everybody goes, oh, well, the paparazzi, they don't count. Or they wanting, you know, to write off people who are interested in preserving animal rights. This is a way to just minimalize people, but in these anti-paparazzi bills, as in the ag bills, it affects anyone who has a camera, who may be photographing or recording, and this is what is our concern.
Right, but how does dissemination play into this? I mean, that girl hadn't even shared any video or photography that she'd taken at that point, and she was almost prosecuted.
Correct. It really depends. Each state has different laws. Some of them, you know, have a possess and distribute component to them. So you may not even be the one to have recorded it, but if you somehow possess those images or distribute them, then you come under the ambit of that law. And again, that would be a First Amendment problem as well. So, you know, we're seeing this thing on so many levels, and people, unfortunately, I think are very narrow, have a very narrow focus, and don't realize that we're literally chipping away little by little at the First Amendment in terms of the protections that we have in this country for news gathering.
Yeah, and was that because of a federal law that's in place, or is that because of the state?
I'm not sure when you say that's because of. I mean, that's because of all.
No, in her particular case.
Different measures that
Every
are constantly being enacted throughout various states, or being attempted to be put into place in various states, and people are just willy-nilly ready to give up certain rights without understanding what they are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And actually, we have Vickery Eckhoff in the studio with us today, and she's encountered her own sort of harassment, I would say.
Infringement on her First Amendment rights.
Yes.
Yes, intimidation.
Yeah, as a journalist. Why don't you tell us about that, Vickery?
Well, back in March, a video came out regarding a horse slaughter plant actually not operating yet in Roswell, New Mexico. And the video showed one of its employees shooting a horse in the head while swearing at animal rights activists. So I have covered the horse slaughter issue very extensively for a number of publications. And I brought the video to the attention of the Valley Meats lawyer. And I asked him a few questions of it about it, and told him I wanted to interview his client. And early in that exchange, he said, He defended Mr. Sappington. That was the video shooter's and the horse shooter's name. He defended him very early on, and he said that I needed to consider that my writing was inciting people to phone bomb and death threats into the company.
And this was a video on YouTube.
This was a video on YouTube. And it was put on there by Tim Sappington, who shot the video and okay. shot the horse. And so this video was on YouTube for a year before it was sent to an animal welfare organization, and they made me aware of it, and I sent it to a couple of news organizations, and I made Mr. A. Blair Dunn, that's the lawyer, aware of it, and asked some questions. And so apparently this video had increased some threats phoned into the company, and so his earliest suggestion that I was somehow responsible for that because of articles that I wrote came out almost immediately. He did not put me in contact with his client, so I called his client and had a very low-key, very uneventful interview. And the very next day, I got an email from the attorney saying that I could be prosecuted under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and that he was turning over all my conversations to the FBI. I think that might have been an idle threat in terms of turning over the tapes, and certainly there was nothing on them. But it was very clear that what he was assailing was my First Amendment right to write anything. Mm-hmm. And I argued with him just a little bit, you know, in an email, and I reached out again to Mr. De Los Santos, who had been very willing to talk to me about this plant. And so I reached out to him again, and I got a second email, and this time it was that I could be criminally prosecuted and that he was going to seek out my editors. And I did not feel he had much of a leg to stand on, but nevertheless, I now can't interview his client. And as I have been watching the coverage of that plant by other journalists, and they don't ask any probing questions. In fact, the coverage that that plant is getting is, in my estimation, full of misstatements of fact. Hmm. And so they've cut off journalists from covering it who ask probing questions, but allowed coverage by journalists who don't.
Well, that's not surprising at all.
Not surprising.
All right. They're
heartening, though.
Of course. We have to take a quick break and check in with our sponsors, but we'll be right back. So keep it locked.
You're listening to Bang Bang Sun by Iggy Dean on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world, highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Hey, we're back with HeritageRadioNetwork.org. This is Sari. I'm in the studio with some very special guests talking about ag gag laws. I have Mickey Osterreicher on the phone. He is with the National Press Photographers Association. He's general counsel. I have Vickery Eckhoff, who is with us from Forbes.com. Katie Kiefer, she's a host here at Heritage Radio Network. And Suzanne McMillan with the director of the ASPCA's Farm Animal Welfare Campaign. We've been having a very, very interesting conversation about ag gag laws and talking about some of the legal implications that have been happening. I want to talk a little bit more esoterically, if that's okay. Katie, I listened last night to an interview that you did on Heritage Radio Network. You interviewed the author and professor Timothy Pacharat, and he had some really interesting things to talk about. He talked a lot about transparency and something that he calls the politics of sight, which is the idea that if things were transparent, specifically within the meat industry, if we could
tune in anytime.
Yeah, exactly. Like that sort of glass wall concept that behaviors. We were talking about, right? Like if we always knew what was happening behind those walls. There's two different sort of.
Well, that would be an interesting experiment.
Actually. It would be an interesting experiment. I really like the point he made that on one hand, the special interest organizations like the ASPCA, like the Humane Society, are very much advocates for that because they want people to know how animals are being treated.
Absolutely.
And whether or not there is sort of a hidden agenda that they believe if there was this sort of collapse of distance, as Dr. Pachterat calls it, if we knew how animals were being treated, maybe there would be less meat consumed. But also, the idea that there's all this fear and paranoia coming from the meat industry that they don't necessarily want people to know what's happening because they would also be concerned that people would eat less meat.
They're very concerned about that. Uh-huh. They are intensely paranoid.
So there's these two different agendas and two different, you know, fears that are taking place. But they're both sort of nervous about the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
But then there's this movement. There's this like major farm to table movement that's happening. And we see it here in New York where people really want to know the animals.
They
want to
do
eating.
A butchering class in the back of Jimmy's number 43.
Exactly. Portlandia
skit. We are a meat eating population, let's face it. And we're exporting our meat eating ways to the third, you know, developing countries. I mean, everybody wants to ingest animal protein, especially if they haven't been able to before. So, I mean, the fact that the meat industry is so extremely nervous about their market share just speaks to what kind of a bubble they live in, because our meat exports are a huge part of our GDP. I mean, the meat industry accounts for 6% of our gross domestic product. So that's a lot of carcasses. I mean, we slaughter 9 billion chickens a year, just to give you a little bit of, numerical context.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this stuff is not going to change. So what we want to see change, I'm not speaking for any of the animal rights groups, but from a sort of my own point of view, I don't see the meat industry going away. But what I do want to see is the meat industry changing it up. And that includes, stop using antibiotics in livestock production, improve your animal welfare and animal handling protocols. Make it safer, as safe as you can. I mean, all of that
kind of
stuff.
Suzanne, why don't you speak up? Because I know that the ASPCA has actually done a lot.
You have a different agenda for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Which point specifically would you like me to highlight? I feel like there's a lot in there that I
Well, I mean, the ASPCA has sort of singled themselves out as like a really unique special interest group because they don't just promote the vegetarian agenda. I mean, you've actually collaborated and given money towards animal welfare in terms of humane slaughter.
We partner with farms and with researchers who are looking to do things better. So that's something we've done in the past and will likely continue to do. We are really concerned about factory farming and the typical conditions that happen in factory farms and trying to improve things incrementally where and as we can. So there's quite a bit to be done there, and even small changes can make a huge difference for these animals because, as was mentioned, we're talking about over 9 billion land animals every year, and for the most part, they are all raised in intensive conditions, essentially in factory farms, enclosed, behind doors, and that's really what underlies this situation, I think, is that the public doesn't know, for the most part, how these animals are being raised. There are no eyes on the industry, and the industry is very interested in keeping it that way. The industry would love nothing more than this sort of continued complacency on the part of the American public, and it's really up to every one of us to recognize that we're a stakeholder in what's happening here, and we need to start asking questions and really making demands of industry.
Right. Yeah, I mean, what I really want to point out here is that we've got Katie, who's... I'm going to call you an advocate for ag gag laws because you've done a lot of work in this field.
I'm not an advocate.
I'm sorry, for anti-ag gag.
No, I would like to see them go away.
Yeah, you're an advocate for the
industry. Improve itself because, and Suzanne, I recognize
you're
a
meat
eater. It's not going to go away. You betcha.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You've been a butcher. I mean, you love meat.
You betcha. I'm in the food business 28 years. I mean, this is what I do. And
this is not a vegetarian agenda that's being
not at all.
Promoted.
But
at all.
I will say that the, I don't know how much you chat with the animal industry, Suzanne, but they view you guys, I mean, they literally call all. It's particularly PETA, Mercy for Animals, who do promote a vegan agenda. But organizations like the ASPCA, HSUS, and like they recognize you guys as terrorists, which at a recent conference for the Animal Agriculture Alliance, I told them a terrorist is a guy who bombs the World Trade Center or the Boston Marathon. It's not somebody who takes an unflattering video of your freaking plant, your packing plant, you know? So it's like, dial back the rhetoric and get with these people and figure out what you can do better. And I think if there was more dialogue between activist organizations like your own and the meat industry, it would benefit everyone.
Right. Yeah, and everyone, sorry, Suzette, I just want to say everyone can, you know, feel free to speak at any moment at this time. I'm not, you know, just interested in like delegating to people. But let's talk about that word. I mean, how detrimental is using rhetoric like terrorist when we're trying to have a conversation about humane animal slaughter? Free for all, go.
Don't jump in at once.
I would just make the point that this goes way beyond even animal welfare. One thing we've done here at the ASPCA is really work to build alliances across networks.
Yeah.
So with groups from the food safety sector, from the consumer protection sector, from the environmental sector, even the farming sector. And so we have worked with some other groups to put together a really wonderfully robust, essentially a sign-on statement, and it's now been signed by about 70 national organizations, including, you know, the Young Farmers Association, you know, groups that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be on. And that's because we've all recognized that we have a common interest in fighting these bills. Mm-hmm. This is not a matter of animal rights versus everybody else. This is a matter of essentially everybody versus big ag.
Yeah. And I'd just like to add something to that, and that is I think there's a failure to distinguish between different types of groups who have a voice on this issue. I think the industry tends to marginalize anyone who has a concern as a quote-unquote animal rights activist.
Or a terrorist.
Or a terrorist. And what that does is it diminishes the public's concerns and voices on this issue. The public has the greatest interest of any constituency, mm-hmm. and yet their voices are marginalized to being animal rights oriented, and they're not. I sometimes wonder whether or not the industry really understands what the animal rights groups are advocating versus welfare groups versus groups that are trying to prevent cruelty and versus groups that represent consumers on a range of issues, which include food safety, because food safety is certainly an issue where ag-gag laws are concerned.
It's a huge issue. And I think if anyone has the biggest share of stakeholders, it's consumers, because they're the ones that are actually consuming the food. And consumers, more than anybody, should actually know what they're eating and what's happening behind, you know, the fortress walls, per se.
But, well, to give you an example of when I was at this Animal Agriculture Alliance last week, and I, granted, I'm taking this quote a little bit out of context, but the opening speaker at this conference, a guy named Joe Miller, made the unfortunate remark, which just goes to show you how little he had vetted his own remarks before he gave them. And he said, "You have no constitutional right to know what's in your food." That was literally his statement, which I have to say, happily, was refuted by virtually every subsequent speaker. I mean, everyone got what a wrong message that sends. And in fact, there is no constitutional right to know what's in your food.
Yeah, I mean, he is right.
As a lawyer, he's speaking accurately. But it showed a mindset, which I subsequently said, you know, when I was giving my remarks, is this is like dinosaur thinking. I mean, you guys have got to like get with your consumer constituency and figure out what it is that they want so you can provide it, or you are going to lose market
share. I just
share.
Can't imagine that ever happening in any other country other than ours.
Too. Oh, it does.
And you,
someone saying,
please, horse meat. Hello.
Well. And strikingly, one of the things that they really don't want consumers to notice is what's in their food. Mm-hmm. For example, hamburger meat. If you look at a hamburger meat label, it might have meat in it from Mexico, Canada, and Uruguay.
Well, today on meatingplace.com, they had a poll. Consumers prefer country of origin labeling, which the World Trade Organization has been trying to throw out because it does label meat from Mexico, meat from Canada, and other nations that don't necessarily have the most stringent protocols in place to protect our food supply. And that is a very real concern, and country of origin labeling is definitely something consumers prefer, and I do hope that it prevails over the WTO.
Certainly. And one of the suggestions with the labeling that had to do with the horse meat crisis, mm-hmm. is the very extensive list of drugs that are in horse meat, and that many of these are extremely dangerous to people in small quantities. And so perhaps a label of on a package of horse meat sold in other countries should say, this could contain all these drugs. Mm-hmm. How otherwise would a consumer know? You have to include, you know, peanuts in your ingredients so that people with nut allergies are not affected. And so these labeling issues are very critical.
Yeah. And so I know we have pending legislation happening in North Carolina, and I'd really just, and I'm sure, you know, many more to come, as this issue feels just more and more potent every day. I just want to hear from all of you, in your opinion, what can people who are listening at home, you know, anyone who actually is concerned about consumer rights and transparency, and just humane slaughter practices, what can people do at home to help advocate for the cause of, you know, just more transparency? And write your congressman.
I would say, go on YouTube and watch some slaughter videos and familiarize yourself with what that slaughter process looks like from several different sources.
Mm-hmm. Including the American Meat Institute, because they've done a couple of really good ones.
Sure.
And another one is coming out.
I think it's worthwhile everybody taking a look at those, because otherwise you simply don't know what's going on behind those walls.
Right. Yeah. Suzanne?
And I would encourage people to visit the ASPCA's website on AgGag. So it's just ASPCA.org/AgGag. There's a lot of information there that will help you track these bills and find out whether you have an active bill in your state, or whether, hopefully you don't, but you may actually have a law already on the books. It's really important to know what your rights are and to be in good touch with your congressional representatives and let them know that you oppose these bills.
Absolutely. And Mickey, did you have anything you wanted to contribute on that?
Sure. You know, just to back up for a second in terms of marginalizing, I think that it's a real problem when all of these traditionally First Amendment protected activities are marginalized or equated to terrorism or equated to some type of criminal activity. And I think it just starts a slippery slope for us to go down, where before long, we're not going to have the freedoms that make this country great. Mm-hmm. And certainly when people should read the text of the bills that are being proposed and understand them, and certainly weigh in and let their legislators know that they object to the bills and why. And that's really important. And so I think there's a number of ways. Obviously, we have our point of view that, you know, this is unconstitutional, that it's an abridgment of free press. But just even talking about the woman in Utah, we believe that, as has been said in a number of court cases, that the rights of the press and the public are coextensive. And we're seeing certainly more and more citizen journalists. Anyone who's got a phone usually has a camera with it, and many images and reporting are coming from those. So it's really important not to just to protect the press's right, but the public's right as well.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, and I wish we could have talked more, Suzanne, about like just specific examples of, you know, campaigns that ASPCA or other organizations have launched, getting people in those factory farms and taking photo and video and actually, you know, really, really making a difference. I mean, I don't think here at Heritage we're necessarily advocating for people to go undercover, but certainly people have and have had really sort of remarkable experiences take place from that. So I really want to thank all of my guests for joining me today, Mickey Osterreicher, Vickery Eckhoff, Katie Kiefer, and Suzanne McMillan. It was really a pleasure to have you here and hear what you had to say on this very important issue. So thank you. This is Sari Kamen from HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Please tune in to our website, HeritageRadioNetwork.org, and you can listen to these interviews and programs online there, or you can check them out on iTunes as podcasts. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.